So, I want you to imagine stepping right into the immediate snow-muddied aftermath of the Southgate battle.
Right into the mess.
Exactly. You are standing in the Palace of All Seasons courtyard, and the pristine snow is just completely ruined, with pooled blood everywhere.
It's a brutal scene.
Yeah, and the air is thick with that specific silence that only follows absolute carnage. And right in the center of it all, this masterclass in psychological manipulation is unfolding.
Oh, absolutely. It's chilling.
Because the shape-shifting tyrant who orchestrated this entire slaughter is just standing there, and he's wearing a face that the entire kingdom trusts.
Right, the face of Lord April.
Yes, and he is just methodically gaslighting everyone present. I mean, he has completely cornered Queen Seraph.
He really has.
And the crazy part is that the only thing capable of breaking his grip on reality is essentially a magical Polaroid
A
camera.
magical Polaroid camera. I love the description because it really is one of the most tense, precarious standoffs in the entire Mirari narrative.
Oh, totally.
I mean, the physical battle might have just ended, but the true war for the realm's perception of reality is happening right there in the courtyard.
Right. So, welcome to today's deep dive. I'm your host, and today we're jumping into this incredibly dense, multi-layered turning point of the Mirari Rebellion.
And I'm so excited to get into this one.
Same here. We are looking at a stack of source text that covers the immediate fallout of that Southgate skirmish. And, since you follow the lore, you already know the stakes here.
The stakes couldn't be higher.
Exactly. But our mission today is to really dig underneath the action. We are going to analyze the underlying mechanics of Eowyn's deception.
And the brutal physical toll that magic exacts on its users in this universe.
Right. Plus, that incredibly heavy psychological burden of not just finding the truth, but actually deciding to act on it.
Yeah, that's the kicker. So, to jump right into that courtyard confrontation, Eowyn is wearing the familiar blonde face of Lord April.
Right, his disguise.
Exactly. And he is publicly accusing Queen Seraph of treason. He's demanding the throne, quote, for the good of Mirari.
Ugh, of course he
And
is.
he even has this bloodied, totally useless left arm just dangling at his side
Yeah.
to really sell the performance.
Wow.
Yeah, he's using his own staged injuries as leverage to paint himself as the aggrieved victim.
Okay, let's unpack this because he is basically leveraging the cognitive dissonance of the crowd, right?
That's exactly what he's doing.
You have all these nobles standing in a courtyard surrounded by the destruction that Eowyn himself caused, but they're exhausted from war.
They're completely drained.
Right, they are starved for stability. So Eowyn knows that if he just presents a narrative that is, easier to swallow than the terrifying reality.
Which is that an ancient murderous entity has infiltrated the palace.
Exactly. If he gives them an out, the nobles will choose the comforting lie. He is literally weaponizing their fatigue.
It's so manipulative.
It is. It's this brilliant, terrifying strategy because he isn't fighting their logic, right? He is just exploiting their emotional exhaustion. It's like modern political gaslighting or, I don't know, a deep fake.
Oh, that's a great comparison. Because he relies on the sheer audacity of the lie. I mean, the nobles are already murmuring in his favor.
Right, because an internal political squabble is familiar.
Exactly. Even a treasonous one is a known quantity.
Yeah.
But a cosmic, world-ending threat, that is not.
No, nobody wants to deal with that on a Tuesday.
Right. They want the familiar, neatly packaged answer. But, that dynamic just fractures completely the moment Alice, Nimue, and Hannah arrive with the Opticon.
Because the Opticon bypasses all of that emotional manipulation. I mean, it doesn't argue, it doesn't
It
debate.
just shows the facts.
Yeah. Hannah steps up and testifies about fighting off those goblin creatures disguised as royal guards just to protect the device.
And then Nimue brandishes the undeveloped egg.
Oh, right. Because the Opticon isn't just a regular recording device, is it? It captures the underlying truth of the soul. It totally strips away the comforting
It
narrative.
really does.
But here's what I keep getting stuck on in this scene. Eowyn has the crowd. He has the political upper hand, right?
Yeah, he's winning.
So why does he drop the disguise the exact moment he realizes the camera exists? Why not just claim the Opticon as a forgery?
Well, because in the Mirari magic system, absolute truth holds a physical, undeniable weight.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, Eowyn recognizes that the Opticon's truth cannot be counterspelled. It can't be politically spun once it's fully developed.
Wow, so he knows he's beat on that front.
Exactly.
Right.
So when Sir Tristan demands Eowyn prove his innocence, Eowyn's calculation shifts instantly from, political conquest to raw survival.
Right.
He realizes the comforting lie has an expiration date of about 5 minutes.
And that shift is visceral. I mean, he drops the blonde disguise, and for a split second, the air just ripples.
The true face is revealed.
Yeah, the sources describe his true face as raven-haired, with these black eyes that act as a window onto pure, timeless cruelty.
It's a terrifying description.
It really is, and he actually mocks Alice, right? He tells her to savor the success before these magical winds just whip around him in sighting circles. Yeah. He vanishes through a siege. He literally creates a magical storm just to exit the conversation.
Which brings us to the harsh reality facing our heroes
the
moment that storm actually clears.
Right, because the problem isn't solved.
Not at all. Exposing a lie, or even just threatening to expose it, doesn't actually solve this systemic problem. It just removes the tyrant's mask.
Yeah.
Now, Alice, Numi, and Hannah have to survive long enough to actually process the proof.
Oh, man.
And the narrative abruptly yanks us from this grand public political theater into this desperately intimate, claustrophobic scene in a palace corridor.
The adrenaline crash there is just brutal. I mean, the moment they are out of the courtyard, Nimi collapses.
It just completely goes down.
Yeah, the seemingly untouchable lady sorceress who just stared down the destroyer is bleeding heavily from a severe thigh gash and a head wound.
She's in bad shape.
She is completely physically compromised. And the narrative forces Alice, who is a literal child with no inherent magical abilities, to step up and take control of the triage.
What's fascinating here is that the author makes a very deliberate choice to ground the high fantasy in mundane, almost gritty biology.
Yeah, it feels very real.
It does. We are in a world where teleportation and shapeshifting are real, but when Nemue falls, magic offers no immediate sanctuary.
Right.
It doesn't negate the pain or the blood loss.
It is deliberately anti-magical. I mean, Alice is digging through her red purse, pulling out raw ginger for Nemue to chew on just to manage the agonizing pain.
It's just raw ginger.
Yeah. And she is examining the leg to see if the bone is broken before applying comfrey leaves. She's literally tearing strips of cloth from Nemue's ruined green gown to make crude bandages.
It's so visceral.
There's no healing spell here. There's no glowing light that knits the flesh back together.
And this contrast highlights the fundamental philosophy of power in the text. Eowyn's power is top-down, effortless, and entirely destructive.
He just waves a hand and a courtyard is leveled.
Exactly. But the resistance against him is bottom-up. It relies on grueling endurance, physical sacrifice, and small, desperate acts of care between allies.
Wow. Yeah.
Magic in Mirari always demands a toll. And right now, Nimue is paying it in blood.
And Eowyn knows they are vulnerable. I mean, he couldn't steal the Opticon with his initial goblin guard, so he springs a secondary trap.
He's relentless.
Two more guards approach the bleeding sorceress and the princess in the hallway, but these aren't human either. One has the head of a monkey, the other a dog.
Nightmare fuel.
Seriously. Nimue attempts to cast a defensive ward, but her physical trauma compromises the spell.
The magic fractures.
Yeah, and it throws both of them out of the physical hallway and into this shared, terrifying psychological landscape.
Right, they're violently pulled into a manifestation of their own subconscious fears.
The store of nightmares.
Exactly. The physical reality of the corridor is replaced. Alice finds herself isolated in this dark, claustrophobic shop dripping with spider webs and filled with twisted, demonic statues.
Ugh, spiders.
It is literally the architecture of a bad dream.
So Alice realizes the Opticon has been snatched by this massive gargoyle statue. And to get it back, she has to physically wade through a puddle of foul-sucking slime. It's oozing over her shoes. It's dripping from the ceiling. When she finally yanks the camera from the stone claws, she falls backward and is just completely covered in this repulsive muck.
Yeah, she's a mess.
But here's where it gets really interesting. It is a fantastic metaphor.
Oh, absolutely.
Because seeking the truth in a profoundly corrupted system is not a clean, noble exercise, you know?
No, it's dirty work.
It is inherently disgusting.
Yeah.
The slime is the collateral damage of seeking the truth. You literally cannot secure the evidence without it clinging to you and ruining your pristine image.
That physical degradation Alice endures perfectly sets up the psychological contrast when she escapes through a back door and enters the fairy ball.
Oh, the fairy ball. What a scene.
She goes from a dark, slimy nightmare into this brilliant, candlelit ballroom with a mosaic marble floor where elegant nobles are dancing to invisible music.
It's so jarring.
It is the epitome of high fantasy grace. But there is a horrific anomaly in the room.
Yeah, just a minor issue. A giant, dark, churning void with glowing eyes is actively eating the ceiling and the walls.
Just a small problem.
Right. A literal monster is chewing away the reality of the ballroom, consuming dancers who twirl too close to the edge, and the nobles are entirely ignoring it. They just keep waltzing.
It is the ultimate manifestation of willful societal blindness.
Yeah.
And amidst this terrifying denial, Alice finds a freckled, red-haired girl named Rebecca, and she's wearing an oversized graduation gown, crying hysterically.
Which is such a weird visual.
It is, and Rebecca is crying because the elegant, powerful version of Lady Nimue, who is gracefully dancing nearby, refuses to acknowledge her.
Right, because Rebecca and Nimue are actually the exact same person. We are literally walking around inside Nimue's fractured psyche.
Precisely. Rebecca represents the vulnerable, deeply insecure core of Nimue's identity.
Wow.
The elegant sorceress dancing at the ball is her carefully constructed, arrogant facade.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. Nimue is so terrified of her true, vulnerable self that she completely dissociates. She clings to the illusion of perfect control, even as a literal monster consumes her mind from the edges inward.
Okay, but I have to challenge the power dynamic here, though.
Go for it.
Why is the ancient master thaumaturge the one living in complete suicidal denial, while the literal child Alice, who is currently covered in nightmare slime, is the only one facing the reality of the void?
It's a great question.
It just seems entirely inverted, you know? You would expect the master sorceress to have the mental fortitude to confront the monster.
You would, but that assumes power grants clarity, when in reality, power often breeds complacency.
Oh, that's deep.
Nimue's idealized self, much like the nobles at the ball, is so deeply invested in her own perfection that admitting the monster is real would require admitting she is flawed.
Right, that she's no longer in control.
Exactly. The ego protects itself by denying the threat entirely, but Alice, being a child, doesn't have an established ego or reputation to protect.
She has nothing to lose.
Right. She isn't invested in the illusion of the fairy ball, so she sees the void for exactly what it is.
And Alice realizes that crying and pleading as a messy child isn't going to break through Nimue's arrogance. She has to speak the language of power to shatter the illusion.
She has to play the game.
Yeah. So Alice casts a glamour on herself, channeling the absolute majesty of her mother, Queen Seraph. She transforms into this shining, regal authority figure and simply commands the room to look up.
And that forced shift in perspective shatters the cognitive dissonance.
Finally.
When the dancers finally look at the maw, the illusion of safety evaporates into total panic. But that disruption, that injection of truth into the delusion, is exactly what allows Alice and the vulnerable Rebecca to locate a magical siege ring on the floor.
And pull themselves out of the dream state.
Exactly.
They snap back to the cold stone floor of the physical corridor. And reality hits hard. Nimue is still bleeding out, Alice still has the camera, and Hannah is right in the middle of driving off the monkey and dog guards with her silver rapier.
The action doesn't stop.
No. The seamless transition from fighting psychological demons back to fighting physical monsters is jarring, but it pushes them forward to the thaumaturge's study.
Gaining entry to that study, however, provides one of the most revealing details about how magic actually functions as a law of nature in Mirari.
The door knocker.
Yes. The door is guarded by a massive gargoyle knocker that animates and demands Alice state her true name 3 times to prove her royal lineage.
So Alice steps up to swear on her name, but on the second attempt, she slips up.
Such a tense moment.
She accidentally names King Richard as her father instead of her biological father, King Mark. And the magic doesn't just reject the password, right? It violently, physically chokes her.
Literally cuts off her air.
Her throat constricts so hard she cannot force the false words out.
It is a critical distinction.
Yeah.
The magic guarding the door doesn't care about Alice's good intentions or her stress levels. It operates on absolute of objective truth.
Think of it like a computer's operating system.
Oh, good analogy.
The magic here isn't some mystical force you can negotiate with, you know. It's a hard-coded script. The moment a variable, in this case, her father's name doesn't match the universal database perfectly, the system throws a fatal syntax error and crashes.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works.
The universe physically rejects the falsehood, choking her until she corrects the input to absolute literal truth. And once she does, the gargoyle merges back into the wood and the doors finally open.
Once inside, the narrative slows down a bit to focus on the meticulous process of unearthing the evidence.
They finally get a second to breathe.
Right. They draw the heavy curtains and Nimue casts luminous rubefacio, bathing the room in a dark red light.
Yeah.
It essentially transforms the magical study into an analog photography darkroom.
There is a beautiful irony there, isn't there?
Totally.
They are using an ancient magical incantation, silver dust, and alchemical vials to process a piece of technological proof.
It's a great clash of themes.
And when the image slowly reveals itself in the red light, it is just chilling. It shows the courtyard, but the man looking back over his shoulder is not Lord April.
No, it's a.
It is Eowyn's true face, captured permanently. The raw data of the Opticon bypasses all of his shapeshifting, all of his gaslighting, and locks his true identity onto the paper.
And finding that true identity recontextualizes the entire conflict. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the sources remind us that Eowyn isn't just a random force of destruction.
Right, he has history.
He was Lord January, an elder brother denied the throne by his own siblings, Lady Angelique and Lord Bram.
Family drama.
Massive family drama. When his family refused to support his claim, his grievance mutated into the monstrous entity he is now.
Wow.
His entire campaign against the palace is fueled by staggering arrogance and a perceived insult that has literally festered for generations. He is the physical embodiment of a toxic grudge.
Knowing exactly who they are dealing with forces our trio into a brutal strategic dilemma.
It really does.
Hannah shares that Lord Thomas, the Lord Explorer, is currently out in the West trying to locate the actual Lord April and gather loyal allies.
Backup is theoretically on the way.
Right. He is scheduled to return with reinforcements in 2 weeks, and our heroes are currently bleeding, exhausted, and vastly outnumbered.
They're a mess.
So the logical safe move is to hide in the study and wait for backup.
But the psychology of the tyrant prevents that. As they evaluate the photograph in the red light, Allison Nimoy recognize that time is Eowyn's greatest weapon.
Every second counts.
Every single hour they delay, Eowyn is out in the palace, twisting the narrative, using the carnage of the South Gate to cement his status as the kingdom's savior.
Now, what does this all mean? It means they decide they cannot wait. They consciously choose to act immediately, armed with nothing but one photograph and their own battered bodies.
It's incredibly brave.
It is. But walking back out into the palace and presenting this undeniable proof to the paranoid, fractured houses is incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, it's a huge risk.
Alice understands that exposing Eowyn might not cleanly stop him. It might actually be the catalyst that sparks a full-blown civil war among the nobles.
Probably will.
But she refuses to let the tyrant consolidate his power in the dark. They actively choose the messy, dangerous reality over safe complicity.
It is the ultimate rejection of the fairy ball mentality.
Oh, definitely.
They are choosing to look directly at the monster, knowing full well that acknowledging it means they have to fight it.
It really makes you evaluate the opticons in your own life, you know?
Oh, for sure.
When you stumble across a piece of raw, undeniable truth that threatens to disrupt the stability of your world, whether that is exposing a deeply toxic culture at your workplace, addressing a fundamental crack in a personal relationship, or facing a harsh societal reality, how do you respond?
It's a tough question.
Do you emulate the elegant nobles at the fairy ball, turning up the music and dancing around the edges while the void quietly eats the room?
A lot of people do.
They do. Or do you make the agonizing choice to wade through the foul, sucking slime to retrieve the evidence, knowing the truth is going to ruin your pristine image?
Yeah. The underlying tension of this entire narrative leaves us with a difficult reality to process.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. Our heroes bled, they faced their deepest psychological nightmares, and they risked their lives just to secure a single photograph.
Just one picture.
But exposing a tyrant's lie with absolute truth doesn't magically defeat him. It merely strips away his disguise and corners him.
Right.
And when you corner a predator, it doesn't surrender. It strikes.
It fights back harder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Think about the implications of that in any complex system. What happens when the undeniable truth isn't the cure that prevents the war, but is the exact spark that inevitably ignites it?
Wow. You break the illusion, but now you have to fight the monster in the light.